It's time for Bigler's World. Ba-ba-doo, right here on Sun Sounds
of Arizona.
And I'm Jim Bigler for the next hour. What do we got here? I've got maybe some Nat Geo, National Geographic for kids. Maybe a little science news explorers. Let's see, what else have we got? Well, just dive right in here. News for kids. Let's do a little news for kids. Boom breaks sound barrier in supersonic test flight. Who wrote this? Doesn't say. Oh, the News for Kids editors. Let's see here. Mojave Air and Spaceport. On Tuesday of last week, an American company called Boom Supersonic made history when its test jet broke the sound barrier. It's the first privately built supersonic jet to go faster than the speed of sound. A supersonic plane is one that can fly faster than the speed of sound, it says right there in the next sentence. The speed of sound, roughly around 767 miles per hour, is often called Mach 1. When a plane breaks the speed of sound, it creates a loud booming sound which can be heard on the ground. The sound barrier was first broken in 1947 by pilot Chuck Yeager. Since then, many supersonic military jets have been built. From the 1970s until 2003, there was even a supersonic passenger jet called Concorde, which flew between the U.S. and Europe. But Concorde planes were built by the governments of the United States and France. Let's see, what does it say here? The Boom's flight last week marked the first time an airplane built by a private company has flown faster than the speed of sound. The plane, called the XB-1, is a test plane. Boom's real goal is to make a jet that can carry passengers. To prepare for that, Boom has been using XB-1 to test out materials and ideas. So the flight seemed to show that Boom's plans will work. It took off from the Mojave Air and Spaceport in California. About 12 minutes after taking off, the plane went supersonic, reaching Mach 1.1, that's 844 miles per hour. The plane stayed at that speed for about 4 minutes. During the 33-minute flight, the XB-1 broke the sound barrier two more times. The entire flight was being closely watched on the ground by a team of 25 engineers. It was the 12th flight for the XB-1, but it was the first at speeds greater than Mach 1. After the flight, the pilot, Tristan Brandenburg, said, "It was smooth and it felt great." Boom's leader, Blake Scholl, says the company will fly XB once more in about a week. After that, he says the company plans to start working on their supersonic passenger jet named Overture. Overture is expected to be about 3 times larger than XB-1, which only has room for a pilot. Okay, Boom says Overture will carry between 64 and 80 passengers. The company's goal for the new jet is to travel twice as fast as regular jets, with an expected speed of Mach 1.7, or 1,300 miles per hour. The Overture could travel between New York and London in about 3.5 hours. There's a lot of work to do before that can happen. Boom must first finish designing the Overture jet. That'd be good. But the company has already built a huge factory in North Carolina. The company claims that once the factory starts running, it will be able to build up to 66 Overture jets a year. The idea of supersonic passenger jets seems to be popular with airlines. Boom already has orders for 130 of its planes. The company hopes the first Overture flights will take place in 2029. And it says here down at the bottom, did you know? Because of the booming noise that breaking the sound barrier creates, the U.S. doesn't allow supersonic flights over land. The XB-1 was tested in the only place in the U.S. where these flights can take place. Once Boom's passenger jets actually start flying, they won't be able to go at supersonic speeds until they are over the ocean. What a bummer, man. Okay, let's see here. Let's do one more article in news for kids right here on Bigler's World. Young scientists take first pictures of rare shrew. Yes, it's a rare shrew. It says right here in the Slug, Eastern Sierra, California. Bum, ba, bum, 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 bum. 3 young scientists have captured the first photos of the Mount Lyell shrew. The tiny animal is the only mammal in California that hadn't been photographed alive until now. The scientists hope their images will help raise awareness about the little-known species. Mount Lyell, shrews are tiny mammals that live in a very specific area of the eastern Nevada, Sierra Nevada mountains. They spend most of their lives underground and feed on insects. The tiny shrews are grayish-brown with small eyes and a long, thin snout. They grow to be about 4 inches long and weigh 2 to 3 grams. That's about as heavy as a U.S. penny. The Mount Lyell shrew was first described by scientists over 100 years ago, but since then, it hasn't been studied much. Three college students, you got Harper Forbes, 22 years old, Prakit Jain, 20 years old, and Vishal Subramanian, he's 22, were determined to change that. The scientists have a history of making news with their scientific discoveries. When they were still in high school, Mr. Forbes and Mr. Jain described and named two new species of scorpion. During their college studies, they learned about trapping and photographing their small animals. But when they discovered the Mount Lyell shrew had never been photographed, they decided they were up for the challenge. The students got permission from California's Department of Fish and Wildlife and set out for the Eastern Sierra in early November. Though it is up in the mountains, much of the area is like a desert, but the young researchers focused on wetter areas near streams. To trap the shrews, they dug over 100 small holes and placed cups containing worms into the holes. Oh, that's how they got me. The idea was that the shrews would fall into these pitfall traps but wouldn't be able to get out. The good news was that the method worked. In just 2 hours, they had already trapped 2 shrews. But the traps also meant that the scientists had to keep working day and night to keep from accidentally killing the shrews they caught. Shrews need to eat almost constantly. If they don't eat every couple of hours, they die. That meant that the students had to keep checking their traps. Mr. Subramanian, he described it this way. It was kind of a go, go, go. You trap some shrews, you photograph them, you release them, and by that time, there are more shrews. More shrews you can shake a stick at. But their efforts paid off. Over the 3-day trip, the students caught, measured, weighed, and photographed several Mount Lyell shrews and then released them. In all, they caught 18. Besides the Mount Lyell shrew, they caught 3 other kinds of shrews. They took small samples of the shrew tails to use for DNA testing. Though Mount Lyell shrews aren't currently considered endangered, they are the only kind of shrew in California that is of a special concern. Scientists believe that climate change could destroy most of the shrew's habitat by the year 2080. Or by the 2080s, I guess it says. The students hope that their pictures will help people learn about Mount Lyell shrews and the challenges they face. Next up here on Bigler's World on Sun Sounds. Let's do one article from Dogo News for Kids. Giant pandas return to the National Zoo! Exclamation point. This was written by Kavi Dalazia. There it is. Giant pandas are back at the Smithsonian's National Zoo in Washington, D.C. after 15 months. 3-year-old Bao Li, is that Lai? I think it's Lai, and Qing Bao made their debut to an excited crowd on January 24th of 2025. The cubs arrived from China on October 15th of 2024, but they had to complete a 3-month quarantine before being introduced to the public. According to zookeepers, the pandas have distinct personalities. Bao Lai, the male, is playful, curious, and loves to be around people. And he likes sushi. King Bao, the female, is cautious and easily scared by new sounds. She often spends time alone, hanging out in trees. The pair are the 9th and 10th pandas to call the nation's capital home. Mai Zhang and Tian Tian, who also lived at the zoo for 23 years with their 3-year-old cub, Zhao Kui Ji, they were returned to China in November of 2023. Their departure left Washington, D.C. without giant pandas for the first time in 53 years. Fortunately, zoo officials signed a new agreement with the China Wildlife Conservation Association, which owns most giant pandas in captivity. Under this deal, Bao Lai and Qing Bao, they will stay at the zoo for 10 years in exchange for an annual fee of $1 million. Yikes. To commemorate Bao Lai and Qing Bao's arrival, the zoo is hosting a two-week celebration from January 29th, so last week, to February 9th of this year, called the District of Panda Party. The event features live music, dance parties, panda trivia, and even yoga sessions with the pandas. Okay, let's go to another publication here. We got a little Sports Illustrated Kids magazine. What is this? Dylan Harper and Ace Bailey. That's the name of the article by Kevin Sweeney. See, Rutgers Scarlet Knights. What is that? The pair of highly touted freshmen are making New Jersey a destination for scouts as they try to rejuvenate their program. How do you pronounce this? Piscataway? New Jersey is the home of Rutgers, and it has always been the kind of place that NBA scouts would visit to check out players on teams facing the Scarlet Knights. But this season, it's the center of attention for NBA talent evaluators planning for the 2025 draft for a different reason. Rutgers has two potential top five picks, Ace Bailey and Dylan Harper. To call, if I can pronounce this again, Piscataway, a surprise locale for future elite NBA talent would be an understatement. Since 1995, Rutgers has finished above 500 in league play just twice. The school's last first-rounder was picked a few weeks before Bailey was born in 2006. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity for the Scarlet Knights to change the perception of their program forever and maybe even reshape how top recruits think about what they should value in a college home. Rutgers coach Steve Peichel, I think that's how you pronounce it, Peichel, he has been in college coaching 32 years, but the scene when Bailey committed to the Scarlet Knights in January of 2023 was unlike any he'd ever experienced before. After a gritty overtime victory over Ohio State, Bailey, who was visiting the school as a junior at Mechern High School high in Powder Springs, Georgia, he approached Peichel in the locker room. Bailey's star was rising, and he didn't intend to commit to Rutgers on his visit, but he was so taken by the atmosphere that he approached Peichel and gave him the good news. "Have you had the good news?" "He's coming!" Peichel yelled out as the coach and player were mobbed in what looked like a championship celebration. Peichel says that he's never received a commitment after a game like that. "It was really the perfect place," Bailey says. Actually, that was either the wrong voice. Getting Bailey on board early was huge because Rutgers had long been in pursuit of another elite prospect in the 2024 class, Harper, a New Jersey native. The versatile guard had been around the program since middle school, watching his brother, Ron Harper Jr., develop into a two-time All-Big Ten performer. Even as stalwart programs like Duke and Kansas were pushing hard to land him, Harper felt Rutgers was even more appealing with Bailey committed. "I just wanted to change the narrative that every kid that is from Jersey leaves Jersey," Harper says. "Every year we have two or three, five, four-star players, but they never come here." Bailey took recruiting matters into his own hands, regularly calling Harper. The two even teamed up on the AAU circuit for a weekend in April of 2023. Harper committed to Rutgers 8 months later. "Go where you're wanted, not where you want to go. That's what my mom always told me," Harper says. Fast friends. When Bailey and Harper got to campus, it became clear that they would form a strong bond. They finish each other's sentences, bicker about when they first officially met, and even lend each other's sneakers for a photo shoot at Rutgers College Avenue gym. "We're basically like family," Harper says. The 6-foot, 10-inch Bailey oozes potential. Having just turned 18 in August and possessing a type of lanky frame and explosive game that resembles a young Kevin Durant, he explodes effortlessly, can't say it, off the floor for dunks. He has the length to shoot over defenses and is a gifted passer. Oh, yes. Harper is also 18, but physically blends more with a roster that's otherwise littered with 22 and 23-year-olds. He looks like a modern NBA lead guard built in a lab. He chiseled 215 pounds at 6'6" with elite court vision and the ability to get to the rim. The two freshmen live in apartments no more than a stone's throw from the team's state-of-the-art practice facility. They have 24/7 access to a gym at the practice facility and take full advantage working out at all hours. It's a basketball lover's paradise, and make no mistake, Bailey and Harper are basketball lovers. Says Bailey, if we can't sleep, we're in the gym. Harper says, you get bored, you go to the gym. Bailey says, you get mad, you go to the gym. Bailey and Harper may have grown up more than 800 miles from one another, but their makeups are very eerily similar. Each grew up in deep basketball families. Harper's father, Ron, won NBA championships with the Bulls next to Michael Jordan and the Lakers next to Kobe Bryant. Harper's mother, Maria, played in Division I and coached him from second grade on, and his brother is already a legend at Rutgers and is now playing in the NBA G League. Bailey's mother, Ramika McGee, father, Richard Bailey, and aunt, Venus Lacey, all played Division I basketball. Lacey won a gold medal for Team USA at the 1996 Olympics. Both kids possess what Paikiel calls old-school values. The work ethic and loyalty that kept them on the path to Rutgers, even when bigger programs started calling. Both are also embracing the challenge of lifting a college hoops also ran into the sport's top tier, and they're realizing it will be a challenge. Two tough losses to ranked SEC teams contributed to a 5-4 start, but Harper, 23.3 points per game, and Bailey, 17.9, have looked like they live up to their expectations placed on them. Who was this talking, Harper? If you get all this hype and pressure, you're doing something right. You'd rather have it than not have it, because if you don't have it, you're chasing it. I think for us, even though we've got it, we're still chasing it, and we're trying to do even more. Okay, one more article here from Sports Illustrated Kids Magazine. This is called Steady Freddy. Tom Verducci wrote this. Throughout the most trying season of his career, first baseman Freddie Freeman was able to stay career first baseman Freddie Freeman and able to stay focused. I don't know what I repeated that. And fight through the pain to lead the Dodgers to a dramatic World Series victory. And here's the article. In the 21 years since the first World Series, no game in the Fall Classic had ever ended on a grand slam. And then Freddie Freeman came along. In the 10th inning of Game 1 in October, Freeman's Dodgers trailed the Yankees 3-2. Freeman was due to bat 6th in the inning, so he just rooted for his teammates to start a rally, never thinking that the game would end up in his hands. But it did. Los Angeles loaded the bases with two outs, and Freeman promptly drove a fastball into the right field seats. The slam propelled Los Angeles to a win in the World Series, and Freeman was named MVP, making a happy end to what was easily the most difficult season for the 15-year vet that he'd ever had to endure. But it was a year that ultimately ended on a high, and not just because of the hardware Freeman racked up. For the 8th time in his career, he was chosen to play in the Midsummer Classic. He took his whole family, wife Chelsea and his 3 sons, 8-year-old Charlie and 3-year-olds Brandon and Max, to the All-Star Game in Arlington, Texas. The family members all became sick with flu-like symptoms, but by the time they got back home, everyone seemed better. Then Max woke up with a limp. Within a couple of days, he wasn't eating or drinking. Freddie was in Houston with the Dodgers when he got a call from Chelsea that Max would have to go to the hospital. Freddie rushed to the airport and flew home. I was just bawling, crying, he says. Doctors ran test after test before they finally were able to correctly diagnose Max's illness. After more than a week in the hospital, he was finally cleared to go home. Freeman missed 8 games, which is one more than in the past 4 seasons combined. He was blown away by the support his family received from the baseball community, says Freeman. One time I'm sitting in the hospital, and the whole Brewers coaching staff sent a video about how they were thinking about us. Angels outfielder Mike Trout, who was on the injured list, offered to help in any way. "Let me do something," Trout told him. "Can I at least bring you donuts?" "Mike," Freeman replied, laughing, "do you think I'm putting donuts in my body right now?" On August 5th, Freeman returned to the lineup. The fans at Dodger Stadium gave him a standing ovation. "Honestly, the baseball community and family that we have, it's special." That's Freeman talking. "You don't know when you're going to need the support system, but it surely shows itself." Just as things were getting better with Max, Freeman developed health problems of his own, lots of them. In mid-August, he broke his right middle finger, fielding a ground ball. Over the next six games, he went 3-for-23. "I don't even remember what happened after Max," says Freeman. "I came back and I was grinding, but I was just there physically. Mentally, I wasn't really there." 1 month later, on September 26th, Freeman suffered a bone bruise and a sprain to his right ankle on an awkward play at first base. 9 days later, he was in the batting cage on the eve of the NL Division Series against San Diego. He felt a minor pain in his rib cage, but kept swinging. He took a cut and was hit with a wave of pain so bad that it knocked him to his knees. He was told that he had basically broken his rib. Freeman had one question. "Can I play with it?" Doctors told him that they would do everything they could to deaden the pain. He kept the injury secret outside the clubhouse. "People were asking, is he going to play or is he not going to play?" Freeman says. "It was all about my ankle, but no one knew about my rib. I was trying to keep that quiet because I didn't want the Padres to know. So we just tried to mask it, and we did a pretty good job." Freeman battled through the pain as LA beat the Padres and then the Mets to advance to the World Series, which set the stage for his heroics. Freeman normally doesn't like scouting reports or using video to prepare, but as he prepared for his crucial at-bat, he asked for an iPad and studied how the New York pitcher, Nestor Cortes, pitched to Dodgers slugger, Shohei Ohtani, who, like Freeman, is a tall lefty. He devised a strategy. "Look for an inside fastball." He stepped into the batter's box, and then Freeman says, "It turned out that he threw it right where I was looking." He launched the pitch into the seats. It was the third straight World Series game in which he homered, and he'd ultimately run that streak to 6 with homers in games 2, 3, and 4. Freeman didn't watch a replay of the Grand Slam until well after the series was over. "After I hit it, we had a game the next day, so it's hard to take it all in," he says. "But then you see all the reactions. When I saw all these people in their homes jumping up and down, running around their houses, it really is amazing. What's so cool about sports is that it can do this to people, bring so much joy and happiness. I don't really understand, but now to see that, it's amazing. I was able to impact people in such a positive way." As for Max, he's doing much better, and his dad expects him to look like a typical four-year-old boy by the time spring training rolls around. "Everything's going to be okay in 2025, hopefully," Freeman says. "If not, and that's going to happen in our lifetime, you just have to handle speed bumps, make sure that car makes it over and lands softly, and then you just keep going." Okay, let's go to another publication. Right here on Bigler's World. Let's do some science news. Explorers. Or should I say science? A lucky lab accident produces Spider-Man-like silk. Researchers can shoot out the material and use it to lift small objects, says Catherine Hulick, who wrote this article. In comic books, Spider-Man swings from skyscrapers hanging from super-strong threads of silk. He shoots these sticky threads from his wrists. Now researchers have found a way to mimic this superhero material in real life. It's the first adhesive that can stick to and lift things from a distance, its developers say. The new material shoots out of a syringe. It emerges as a liquid, then quickly hardens into a strong thread, and it sticks to almost anything it touches. Once hardened, the thread can lift objects up to 80 times its own weight. In lab tests, researchers lifted wood blocks, steel nuts, test tubes, and more. And let's see what it says. Marco Lo Presti. He's been working on developing sticky materials at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. Fiorenzo Omenetto directs the Silk Lab, where Lo Presti works. The two teamed up with chemists at the University of Bari in Italy, to create the new material. When the group talked with each other about this work, they always called it the Spider-Man experiments, says Gianluca M. Ferrianola, one of the Bari chemists. For now, though, Spider-Man gets to keep his job. Let's see, what's this? This is Rosalind Abbott. She's a biomedical engineer at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She didn't take part in the research, but she did say this. I don't think you're going to be able to swing off buildings using this yet, agrees Omenetto. Don't try this at home. Even though the new material isn't quite ready to fight crime, it has superpowers, he adds. Abbott agrees. It's very cool. An accidental discovery. As he worked on this project, says Lo Presti, I was feeling like Peter Parker. That's the fictional superhero's real name. In the comics, he's a chemist and engineer. Peter Parker got his superpowers accidentally from the bite of a radioactive spider. Lo Presti discovered the superpower material by accident, too, but no spiders were involved. Back in 2021, Lo Presti had been developing an adhesive that could stick securely underwater. He started with cocoons from silk moths. This is the first step for most of the Silk Lab's work. They boil the cocoons down to break them down. This produces a substance that is basically liquid silk. Lo Presti then mixed in another chemical. This one mimicked a sticky substance mussels produce to secure themselves to underwater rocks. His underwater adhesive worked well, but then one day, Lo Presti was cleaning his lab experiment with acetone. That's the same chemical solvent used in many nail polish removers. At once, he noticed something strange. His silk mixture rapidly turned solid. Let's see, it was looking like a web, Lo Presti says. Almost immediately, he imagined creating some sort of web shooter to disperse the material. And that's what his team has now done. The team came up with several different silk recipes for their web shooter. These include different additives that alter the thread's properties. One substance makes the silk thread stronger. Couldn't say that. It solidifies faster, too. Another makes the silk thread stickier, though not quite as strong, says Abbott. They really tailored those recipes for different applications. Spider-Man uses his web shooter to escape bad guys. He also shoots silk to catch criminals and whisk innocent bystanders to safety. This new material can't do any of those things. Still, it could be put to good use. For example, someone might use it to pick up delicate objects. Abbott's lab used silk-based materials in biomedical engineering. Part of her work involves developing bio-inks to use in 3D printing. Bio-ink is a liquid that can harden into a structure that supports the growth of living cells. The fact that the new material hardens so quickly, she says, might be very useful for this. Meanwhile, Lo Presti has a different end goal. He hopes to replace plastic-based adhesives, plural, with biodegradable alternatives such as silk. I'm trying right now to work on particle board, he says. Currently, particle board makers mix wood chips with toxic glues. These do not break down easily. Instead, using silk-based glues could make this and other products more sustainable, he says. Peter Parker would surely approve. Okay, let's go to another publication here on Bigler's World. On Bigler's World, on Sun Sounds of Era. Zona. That's our new jingle. I think we're going to put that on tape. What do we got here? Let's go to Frontiers for Young Minds. This article, kind of a heavy article, Treating Addiction by Stimulating the Brain with Powerful Magnets. Who is this? Kada Kanan Kaglar wrote this, along with Doga Altanir and a few others. They put a lot of people on these articles. Starts out like this. What is addiction? Imagine that you really love chocolate and you want to eat it all the time. Even when you feel full from all the chocolate you ate, you still find it hard to stop eating more. So you eat a little more, even though you know it will make you feel sick if you do. If you do this a lot, it can also be bad for your health. For example, you might become overweight or develop diabetes. Addiction works the same way. But instead of chocolate, it involves things like alcohol, cigarettes, or other drugs. A person is addicted when they cannot do anything without using their drug. People with an addiction often know that using drugs is bad for them, but they find it very difficult to stop. Cigarette smoking is a common addiction for many adults and sometimes even strangers. Did you know that 28,300,000 adults in the U.S. smoke? That is more than one in every 10 people. You probably know that smoking is bad for you. It damages the heart and can cause lung cancer. In fact, one in every 5 deaths in the U.S. is due to smoking. This is a big problem because most people start smoking at a young age without knowing it's bad for their health. Smoking does not only affect people's health, but it also changes how the brain works. Two behaviors that are different in people with an addiction are craving and cognitive control. You can think of these as gas and brake pedals of a car. When someone craves smoking, they feel a strong urge to smoke a cigarette. So craving makes someone do things like smoke or using the gas pedal. Cognitive control is like being the boss of your own actions. It is what helps a person control and think about their behavior. Cognitive control is like using the brake pedal on behavior. When someone becomes addicted, for example, to cigarettes, the craving becomes stronger and cognitive control becomes weaker. This is why people keep smoking even when they no longer enjoy it. They cannot resist the urge to smoke. Because it is so hard to stop smoking cigarettes, most people need help to quit successfully. Changing the brain from the outside. When someone is addicted to something, there are ways to help them quit. These can include talking to a therapist about why they want to keep using the drug and how they can learn to resist the craving to use it. Medication is another option. Certain medicines can help people resist the desire to use the drug or make them very sick when they do use it. But these treatments do not always work for everyone, and sometimes people start smoking again, even if they did stop smoking before, which is called relapse. It is very important to keep finding new treatments that can help more people successfully overcome their addictions. One of these new treatments could involve changing how the brain works. Remember that we said that the brain works differently when someone has an addiction? Remember that when I said it? This means that some brain areas have more activity, leading to more craving, and some areas have less activity, leading to less cognitive control. The brain areas responsible for craving and control are called the prefrontal cortex, or the PFC, and the insula, whatever that is. Changing the activity of these brain areas might help people have less craving and give them more control over their addictions. Stimulating the brain can change its activity. There are two ways to stimulate the brain: invasively, meaning from inside the skull, and non-invasively, meaning from outside the skull. Stimulating the brain invasively involves surgery to open the skull and put a stimulator in the brain. This is called deep brain stimulation. You can read more about this in the Frontiers for Young Minds article. They have one here. I'm not going to read it because I got this one right here. But deep brain stimulation can be dangerous because surgeries have potential risks like bleeding and infections. Non-invasive methods do not have the risks associated with surgery because they stimulate the brain from outside the skull. One of these methods is called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. Can you guess what this means? Anybody? The name actually describes exactly what the method does. Trans means through, and cranial means the skull. So it means magnetic stimulation that goes through the skull. You got it? TMS has already been used to help people with problems like depression. That's feeling very sad, it says here. If you want to read more about that, okay, I'm not going to read it right now. How does TMS work? Brain cells can be stimulated using a magnetic field that goes through the skull. The stimulation can increase or decrease the electrical activity of the brain cells in a specific brain area. Typically, these brain cells are close to the skull. In a new type of TMS, areas that are further away from the skull can be stimulated, like the insula. That's I-N-S-U-L-A, insula. That's why it's called deep TMS. Similar to typical TMS, deep TMS can also change the activity of brain cells in a certain area. It can target the deeper brain areas responsible for more craving and less cognitive control in addiction. In this way, TMS can help restore the brain's activity and potentially become a useful way to treat addiction. TMS is not as risky as invasive stimulation, but it may cause side effects like dizziness or headaches after treatment. Does deep TMS help people with smoking addiction? Well, they better answer that because I got this far in the article. Remember that people with smoking addiction might really want to stop smoking, but find it hard to do so because they have more craving and less cognitive control. These symptoms of addiction are caused by changed activity of the PFC and insula. Scientists have found that this brain activity can be changed by stimulating these brain areas non-invasively, which can change how much craving and cognitive control someone has. This is how we can use TMS to help people stop smoking. Researchers have done several scientific studies to find out if this works. For example, in one study, researchers worked with 262 people who had tried to quit smoking at least three times before, but could not. For 3 weeks, half the people got the real deep TMS to increase the brain activity. The others got got the fake stimulation that feels and sounds the same but has no brain effect. The two groups got the treatments every day for 3 weeks and then once a week for three more weeks. The treatments were given after making the participants want to smoke by showing them things related to smoking. Researchers checked if the participants had stopped smoking by asking them to write down if they smoked each day and testing their urine to see if they had smoked. The main goal of this study was to see how many people stopped smoking for 4 weeks straight by the end of 18 weeks. Researchers found that after real deep TMS, people smoked less and had less craving compared to fake TMS. Some studies show that deep TMS helps reduce craving, while others show that it does not make a big difference. Although researchers are still investigating the effects of TMS on craving and smoking, one explanation, I couldn't say that, could be that TMS affects cognitive control. If you think back to the scale analogy, when cognitive control becomes heavier, craving becomes weaker in comparison. This could lead to TMS being effective for stopping smoking without a change in craving. However, some scientists combined the results of a bunch of studies and concluded that TMS is a promising treatment for quitting smoking and reducing craving. Okay, next article here on Bigler's World. Let's do a little National Geographic Kids. Little Nat Geo Kids. We just had the groundhog at Punxsutawney Phil. This is a thing on groundhogs. Stuff that maybe you didn't know about it. Groundhog by Jed Winner. It might be Weiner. The common name is groundhog. The scientific name is Marmota monax. Remember that. It's a mammal. It's an herbivore. And the size, the head and the body, 17.75 to 24 inches tall. And it is 7 to 9.75 inches. That's the tail. Sorry. The weight, 13 pounds. And it says right here, Phil, the groundhog, is a star. Well, at least on February 2nd he is, or he was. Phil lives in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, where every Groundhog Day people wait for him to come out of his burrow. Legend has it that if Phil sees his shadow, 6 more weeks of winter will follow, which is what happened. Also known as woodchucks, I did not know that, groundhogs spend much of their days alone, foraging for plants and grasses, and digging burrows up to 66 feet long. So, though Phil might be a celebrity once a year, the rest of the time he probably prefers his me time. Look out below. Groundhogs often burrow under open areas, such as meadows and farmlands, which can make the critter a nuisance to farmers. But burrows are super important to the groundhogs and their ecosystems. Burrows are where the rodents sleep, raise their babies, and even poop. They actually have a separate bathroom. Burrows also provide protection from predators such as coyotes, hawks, and black bears. And Bill Murray. And it's not just the groundhog that uses its burrow. No. Animals like rabbits, chipmunks, and snakes move in once a groundhog is moved out. Plus, burrowing is good for habitats. Digging aerates or provides oxygen to the soil, which helps plants better absorb nutrients that help them grow. Deep sleep. So can groundhogs really predict when spring is coming? It says right here, nope. They're not going to mess around. Nope. The rodents enter their burrows to hibernate in the winter and come back out of the ground the same time every year. Males poke their heads out in early February, not to forecast more winter weather, but to claim their territory. In the spring, females give birth in their dens to about 3 to 5 pups, but they don't hang out for long. By around 2 months old, they're off on their own, whether they see their shadows or not. Next article here. Sticking with National Geographic kids, Canada's been in the news. Our friendly neighbors to the north. They got all kinds of stuff about Canada. Canada is a vast and rugged land. From north to south, it spans more than half the northern hemisphere. Here's some fast facts. Fast facts. Official name, Canada. Form of government, a federal parliamentary state. I don't like the sound of that. The capital is Ottawa. The population is 35,881,659. Official languages are English and French. Money is the Canadian dollar. And their area, like I said, they're big. 3,849,674 square miles of rugged land. Major mountain ranges. You got your Rockies, your coast, and your Laurentian. Major rivers, St. Lawrence and the Mackenzie. Like it's the Mackenzie River, eh? Let's go with some geography. Canada is a vast and rugged land. I think we've already pointed that out. From east to west, it stretches almost 4,700 miles across 6 time zones. It is the second largest country in the world, but it has only 0.5% of the world's population. Canada features black, blue lakes, numerous rivers, majestic western mountains, rolling central plains, and forested eastern valleys. The Canadian Shield, a hilly region of lakes and swamps, stretches across northern Canada and has some of the oldest rocks on Earth. Canada's far north lies in the frozen grip of the Arctic, where ice, snow, and glaciers dominate the landscape. Few trees grow here, and farming is not practical. Native Canadians, called First Nations people, live in this region by hunting and fishing. And speaking of people and culture, in some ways, Canada is many nations in one. Descendants of British and French immigrants make up about half the population. They were followed by other European and Asian immigrants. First Nations people make up about 4% of the population. Inuit people live mostly in the Northwest Territories and Nunavut. Nunavut means anything to me. No, Nunavut's a place. Nunavut. Many Native Canadians live on their traditional lands, but many others have moved to cities across Canada. First Nations artwork is widely recognized and seen as a symbol of Canadian culture. Then there's nature. Canada's remote north and extensive forests are home to wildlife from bears, wolves, beavers, deer, mountain lions, and bighorn sheep, to smaller animals like raccoons, otters, and rabbits. The country's lakes and rivers, which contain about 20% of all fresh water on Earth, are full of fish such as trout and salmon. Canada's prairies in the south are home to bison and pronghorn antelope. Farther north are Canada's sprawling evergreen forests, which have a lot of wildlife, including moose and black bears. Even farther north is the cold bear tundra, where herds of caribou and musk ox live. Canadians work hard to protect the native wildlife. Canada has 41 national parks and 3 marine conservation areas. Nevertheless, species like wolves, lynx, and Atlantic fish have been overhunted and overfished. Then there's the government and economy. The British monarch is the head of state in Canada. The monarch is represented by a governor general who has very limited powers. Laws are made by Canada's elected federal government, which includes parliament and a prime minister. Britain's Quebec Act of 1774 granted Quebec its own legal and religious rights. Despite this concession, many Quebec citizens have long sought independence. The votes held in 1980 and in 1995, Quebec decided to stay in Canada, but the second vote was very close, and the debate is still alive. Canada has provided fish, furs, and other natural resources to the world since the 1500s. Today, it is a world leader in agricultural production, telecommunications, and energy technologies. The vast majority of Canada's exports go to the United States. History. The first people to come to Canada arrived between 15,000 and 30,000 years ago across a land bridge that joined Asia and North America. Around AD 1000, the Viking explorer Leif Erikson reached Newfoundland, Canada. He tried to establish a settlement, but it didn't last. In the 16th century, French and British settlers arrived. Land disputes between farmers and fur traders led to 4 wars between 1689 and 1763. The final war, called the French and Indian War, left the British in control of Canada, but French influence remains strong even today. In 1867, Ontario, Quebec, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick combined to form a dominion with its own government, parliament, and prime minister. Manitoba joined soon after. In 1931, Canada became an independent nation. Okay, next up here, on Bigler's World, on Bigler's World. Let's do a little student news daily. Bum, 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 bum. Secretary of State Rubio made acting administrator of USAID. You don't say who wrote this. It's compiled from Reuters, RCP, and OANN. Not sure what that is. Secretary of State Marco Rubio confirmed Monday that he has been made acting administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development. President Donald Trump and his team are having discussions about merging USAID into the State Department in order to significantly reduce the size of the agency's workforce for efficiency purposes, a senior White House official told Reuters on Monday. The Trump administration planned to send a notification to Congress soon on Trump's plan to revamp USAID, the official said. Trump has entrusted Elon Musk to oversee the project, the official added. Secretary Rubio made the announcement during his 5-nation trip to Central America while answering questions from the press at a maintenance firm. There is Aeroman in San Luis Talpa, and that's in El Salvador. Let's see here. It says, when questioned by a reporter about USAID, Secretary Rubio explained, "My frustration with USAID goes back to my time in Congress. It's a completely unresponsive agency. It's supposed to respond to policy directives of the State Department, and it refuses to do so. The functions of USAID, there are a lot of functions of USAID that are going to continue, that are going to be a part of American foreign policy, but it has to be aligned with American foreign policy. I said very clearly, during my confirmation hearing that every dollar we spend and every program we fund will be aligned with the national interest of the United States. USAID has a history of ignoring that and deciding that it's somehow a global charity separate from the national interest. These are taxpayer dollars. I'm very troubled by these reports that they have been unwilling to cooperate with people who are asking simple questions about what these programs do, who gets the money, who our contractors are, and who is funded. That level of insubordination makes it impossible to conduct a mature and serious review that I think our foreign policy writ large should have. We are spending taxpayer money here. These are not donor dollars. These are taxpayer dollars, and we owe the American people the assurance that every dollar we are spending abroad is being spent on something that furthers our national interest. So far, a lot of the people that work at USAID have simply refused to cooperate. A reporter next asked Secretary Rubio, "Are you currently in charge of USAID?" To which he responded, "I am the acting director of USAID. I've delegated that authority to someone, but I stay in touch with him. Again, our goal was to go in and align our foreign aid to the national interest. But if you go to mission after mission and embassy after embassy around the world, you will find that in many cases, USAID is involved in programs that run counter to what we're trying to do in our national strategy with that country or with that region. That cannot continue. USAID is not an independent, non-governmental entity. It's an entity that spends taxpayer money, and it needs to spend it, as the statute says, in alignment with the policy directives that come from the Secretary of State, the National Security Council, and the President. For 20 or 30 years, people have tried to reform it, and it refuses to reform. It refuses to cooperate. When we're in Congress, we couldn't even get answers to basic questions about programs. That's not going to continue. I've articulated my challenges with it, and they go back to my time in Congress. We would ask them questions. Who does this program fund? Who gets the money? The responses we got, we won't tell you. We don't need to tell you. We are apolitical. American foreign policy isn't apolitical. American foreign policy is about furthering the interests of the United States. If someone wants to spend apolitical dollars, they should spend private dollars. Go start a charity, and you can fund anyone you want. But if you're going to spend taxpayer money, then you need to spend it furthering the national interests of the United States. That's exactly what I said at my confirmation hearing, and this is not just my frustration. This has been the frustration for almost a quarter century, spanning multiple administrations. It's going to stop, and it's going to end. The reporter then asked, "A lot of the money USAID spends that is being criticized as charitable, you use that word, or welfare for poor countries. Defenders of USAID and some members of Congress say it is America's national interest and promotes stability or buys American goodwill overseas. What is your reaction to that? Do you think USAID does good work and you have issues with some of the specific spending?" Secretary Rubio then explained, "My issue, as I said, is that there are things USAID does that we should continue to do, and we will continue to do. But everything they do has to be in alignment with the national interest and the foreign policy of the United States. The attitude that USAID has adopted over the years, no, we are independent of the national interest. We fund programs irrespective of whether they align with foreign policy. That's ridiculous. These are tax dollars. Every penny that we spend in foreign aid needs to be in furtherance and aligned with the national interest and foreign policy of the United States. So this is not about ending USAID programs. There are things it does that are good, and there are things that it does that raise strong questions. It's about the way it operates. They're supposed to take direction from the State Department on policy. They do not take policy direction. They are uncooperative when you ask questions. When you try to find out basic information, their attitude is, we don't have to answer to you because we are independent. We answer to no one. That's not true, and that will no longer be the case. USAID employees were reportedly told early on Monday to stay home from the Washington offices after Musk asserted that President Donald Trump had agreed to shut it down. USAID staffers also received an email that its Washington headquarters would be closed on the same day, according to two sources who spoke with Fox News Digital. Nonetheless, thousands of USAID personnel have already been let go, and activities have been halted in the 2 weeks since Trump took office. According to USAID officials, more than 600 additional employees were shut out of the assistance agency's computer systems overnight. Those who remained in the system received emails stating that, at the direction of the agency leadership, the HQ building will be closed to agency personnel on Monday, February the 3rd. Okay, we'll do one more article here. In Student News Daily, bum bum, did China's DeepSeek improperly obtain data? Distillation, this is a quotation mark here. Distillation is a process by which an actor asks a deep neural network such as ChatGPT tons and tons of questions in order to collect its answers. It sucks the knowledge of the teacher model, the one being asked the questions, to the student model. It's a large-scale knowledge transfer. It isn't illegal as far as U.S. law goes, but it does violate OpenAI Terms of Service, which were last updated December 11th, 2024. They state that those who use OpenAI services or products may not automatically or programmatically extract data or output or use output to develop models that compete with OpenAI. Feature that. Distillation does not expose a model's inner workings. It can be used by developers to improve their applications, the spokesperson noted. However, OpenAI's terms of service bar users from using the data obtained through distillation to build competing AI products. DeepSeek sent shockwaves through the American AI industry with the release of its R1 open-source reasoning model last week. The Chinese startup claims its model performs on par with OpenAI's latest model and costs just $5.6 million to train with a couple of thousand reduced capacity chips. DeepSeek now sits atop Apple's App Store after overtaking OpenAI's ChatGPT. Let's see, what is this? DeepSeek says it only needs 2,000 specialized chips from NVIDIA to train its V3. This is in comparison to a reported 16,000 or more required to train leading models, according to the New York Times. Microsoft, a close partner of OpenAI, is reportedly also investigating the issue after its researchers noticed individuals potentially linked to DeepSeek extracting large amounts of data from the AI firm's application program interface last fall, according to Bloomberg. White House AI crypto czar David Sacks claimed Tuesday that there is a substantial evidence that DeepSeek used distillation to pull information from OpenAI models. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick also accused DeepSeek of ripping off U.S. tech firms and violating U.S. export bans on chips to build its model. And he says this, we need to drive our innovation and we need to stop helping them. You know, open platforms, Meta's open platform, let DeepSeek rely on it. NVIDIA's chips, which they bought tons of, they found their ways around, drive their DeepSeek model. And it just ends right there. And with that, I got to end right here. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye. Bye.